The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Making Precision Decisions in the Treatment of Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer with Common and Uncommon EGFR Mutations, How to Navigate the Expanding Options and Increasing Complexity. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/SKH860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hi, welcome everyone. Exciting start to the TTLC 2024. It's great to see so many familiar faces. We're going to be discussing making precision decisions in the treatment of non-small cell lung cancer with common as well as uncommon EGFR mutations. We'll be discussing how to navigate the expanding options and increasing complexity in the EGFR space. So I'm Dr. Joshua Sabari, thoracic medical oncologist at NYU Langone Health Perlmutter Cancer Center, and I'm joined by my two esteemed colleagues, both who have served as mentors to me in my career, so thank you for that. Dr. Alexander Spira at Virginia Cancer Specialist Research Institute, part of Next Oncology in Virginia, and Dr. Jyoti Patel at the Lurie Cancer Center at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. So our goals for today are, first off, to improve skills in biomarker testing. We want to ensure detection of different common as well as less common EGFR mutations, as well as other key alterations in non-small cell lung cancer. Remember, you can't be a good physician practitioner in 2024 without broad panel next generation sequencing. We also want to enhance the ability to apply new data to develop individualized treatment plans for patients with non-small cell lung cancer exhibiting different EGFR mutations. So let's jump into identifying and testing for EGFR mutations, and we'll cover the different EGFR subtypes. This has become a very complex space over the last 5 to 10 years. So we've all heard of the activating or common EGFR mutations. You know, these make up 75 to 80% of all EGFR mutations. Exon 19 deletion and L858R exon 21. The reason we call these activating is because they're responsive to first, second, and third generation EGFR TKI. But as you can see, they're in different locations in the EGFR gene. The less common or uncommon, also sometimes called atypical EGFR mutations, are less responsive to standard EGFR therapy like a third generation EGFR TKI, and potentially more responsive to second generation EGFR TKI. Those include the G719, S768I, and less so the L861Q. The rarest of them all are EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations. These make up about 5 to 10% of all EGFR mutations and are inherently resistant to first, second, and third generation EGFR TKI. So we'll hear a lot from Dr. Spira this evening about how we think about focusing treatment for the EGFR exon 20 population. So just to hone in on exon 20 for a moment, because it may not be as common to us or as routine as the exon 19 del or L858R, these make up about 5 to 10% of all EGFR mutations and occur about maybe in 1 to 2% of all non-small cell lung cancer. And these numbers really may be limited by our testing modalities. We know that NGS is really the gold standard, and I'll show you some data. When we look at older first and second generation EGFR TKI, really response rates, durability of response are quite poor. Median PFS about 1.5 to 2 months for first and second generation EGFR inhibitors. And we know even for conventional chemotherapy, carboplatin, pemetrexed, median progression-free survival in the frontline setting ranges between 7 and 8 months. So this patient population has a worse prognosis compared to our exon 19 del and L858R counterparts. So how do we test? Really, if you look at the NCCN guidelines, no matter what your histology, no matter what your clinical characteristics, you know, sex, age, smoking status, we really need to do broad panel next generation sequencing on all patients. And remember, EGFR is not just the common mutations, and a lot of times, you know, IHC that gets reflexed or PCR-based assays may miss a lot of the more atypical or uncommon EGFR mutations. We also have liquid biopsy now, which is helping us identify these alterations more quickly. Remember, if non-diagnostic, you do need to fall back on tissue-based NGS. I love this slide from Dr. Bammel back when he looked at, in the real-world data set, the identification of the EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations, which we talked about being uncommon. When you use PCR-based assays, we miss about 50% of these alterations. We've now identified over 100 different EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations, and it's critical to do broad panel next-generation sequencing to confirm that you identify these alterations for our patients for potential match-targeted therapy. So let's talk about some practical guidance for interpreting and applying new data on expanding therapy options for patients with EGFR mutations. I want to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Alex Spira.
Thank you, Josh. So now we're going to talk about the evolving role of EGFR-targeted therapy in early stage, stage 1-3 non-small cell lung cancer. We'll look at a case first, and then we'll open up for questions and ask my colleagues here their thoughts as well. So, 64-year-old woman, non-smoker, presented with a cough. Chest CT showed about a 3.5 centimeter left upper lobe mass, as seen here. It was solid appearing, normal pleura, with no clear evidence of metastatic or distant disease, and an endobronchial ultrasound showed no involved nodes. Biopsy showed invasive lung cancer with an exon 19 deletion. PD-L score was 2-4%, so low PD-L score. So summarizing, early stage cancer, at least on CT and initial biopsy, exon 19 deletion with a low PD-L score. About a week later, pretty fast, patient was taken to the OR, and at that time, the patient underwent surgical resection, did fine postoperatively. Patient had a 4.4 centimeter, so slightly bigger tumor, invasive adenocarcinoma. Moderately differentiated pleural invasion, visceral pleural invasion, multiple lymph nodes that were not detected on previous biopsy, 2 level 5, 1 level 7, 2 bronchial. So pathologic staging, T2B N2, upstage. What would you recommend for this patient? So I'll turn it to both of you right now. So I'll let you go first, Jody. What are your thoughts? What would you do?
Sure, thanks so much. Certainly, you know, these surprise N2 nodes are always difficult. Had we detected those, the patient probably would have gotten induction chemotherapy prior to surgery. Certainly, we know that chemotherapy improves overall survival, and so I'd absolutely recommend 4 cycles of platinum-based therapy followed by osimertinib. And, you know, we haven't really tested this. Certainly in ADORA, which we'll talk about, there are patients who declined chemotherapy or didn't get chemotherapy, and they had survival benefits. But this patient is at high risk. She has stage 3 disease and would definitely recommend chemotherapy for her.
You know, this is one of the things I struggle with, because if you look back, and I'm probably the only one old enough to remember, the first study that was positive for adjuvant chemotherapy was IALT. A couple of others came back afterwards. And there is, depending on how you looked at it, between a 4 to 10% benefit, probably closer to 4% benefit for adjuvant chemo. And certainly I think there's increasing toxicity here. So depending on the patient, I probably would lean more towards adjuvant osimertinib. Just because I don't think the benefit of chemo is probably worth the toxicity. We know about that, but obviously this is, I think, a controversial area. Josh,
yeah,
your turn.
I agree with Jyoti here. So I think N2 disease, you really do need to think about curative intent adjuvant chemotherapy. You're right that the rate of cure is quite low, right? 5% reduction in recurrence with adjuvant chemo, but chemo does cure patients. It's important to note that as good as our targeted therapies are, they do not cure patients in the metastatic setting, but clearly do not cure patients in the early stage setting as well. So I would use adjuvant chemo. The only thing I would say, if patient was frail, I may pull back. Jyoti, what would you use chemotherapy-wise here? You're a disciple of MGK, Dr. Chris.
The greatest, right? So I would use cisplatin for a patient who is well and could tolerate it. Certainly, I think my bar to move to carboplatin has changed with the adjuvant TKI data. But again, you know, the sort of delta of benefit is also driven by stage. And given that it's stage 3 disease, it's likely that the OS benefit from chemotherapy is greater than 4% and probably double digits.
So let me ask you a question. So the patient comes in, they're sitting in front of you. You know, let's push the age up to like 60 or so, maybe a little diabetes. How much do you convince the patient that you want to give them chemotherapy? If they say, doc, do I really need to do it? Is that something you give into, or are you insisting based upon the data?
Say level 1 evidence, you should get chemotherapy.
Okay.
Yeah, I think a little diabetes, hypertension, that's our baseline patient. Even our patient with the EGFR mutant disease, you know, obviously those patients are somewhat healthier, but this is a population where, you know, stage three, there's a 70% chance of recurrence. We don't know the data, you know, thus far in the EGFR mutant population. Obviously, it may be a little bit better with adjuvant osimertinib, but I clearly would offer chemotherapy here. I've had patients decline, and that's a different discussion.
Yeah, and I think there's probably different practice patterns no matter who you go to as well. So now I'll ask the next question. So the study gave osimertinib for 3 years. And I think that's a somewhat arbitrary number, as do we all. I mean, you know, most other studies, you know, some of them, we'll talk about one in a few minutes that gives it indefinitely adjuvantly. This is 3 years, it could have been 1 year, it could have been two, it could have been indefinitely. What do you tell people?
So we're certainly getting to that 3 year mark for a lot of our patients and starting to have these discussions in real time. You know, when I started them on osimertinib 3 years ago, I said, for now, it's 3 years. Perhaps the data will change. Certainly, I think the published data and the OS benefit helps me feel that 3 years is adequate. There are patients that I think would be motivated to go beyond 3 years, and I don't necessarily dissuade them.
I have a question here from the audience. We talk a lot about 1B to 3A, but what about a patient with stage 1A disease, right? Recurrence rates are 5, 10%. What do you tell a patient with a 1A disease, tumor less than, let's say, 2 centimeters or even 3 centimeters?
You know, so for me, I follow the literature, and right now for 1A, the risk of recurrence is so low that your marginal benefit is going to be low, and I don't give them chemotherapy, number one, and I would follow the letter of the law, and I would not give them any therapy.
What about for 1B? That's the, right.
So that's a tough one, right? Because they were included, but obviously you're looking at a patient, and you know, that gets, I kind of think about it as well as I look to the next population is, you know, osimertinib is a very well-tolerated drug, and I follow the letter of the rule. I gave it for 3 years because that's what the study shows, and that's what we did. But you all look at those patients, and about 2 years in, they all start to feel it, right? And we're all wondering in our mind, is this something that you could stop, or do you need to continue indefinitely? Why 3 years? So for me, it depends, if they're young and motivated and I'm concerned, for 1B, I'll do it. But as they get older, I think we all realize that, you know, these drugs do have real side effects, and, you know, it amazes me. I tell people with immunotherapy all the time, therapy is benign, but you realize what you felt like once you stop it. So I would give it in 1B, but I, you know, if they tell me nah, I'm okay with that as well.
We've been embracing perioperative therapy because of immunotherapy. And so what would, I guess, first of all, how often do you have your NGS data back to guide therapy in a timely enough fashion? And with the knowledge that this patient, you knew the patient had N2 disease, would you have approached it differently?
Now that's a great question, what to do in that scenario. I mean, all N2 is not the same, and it's a big gamish of everything. For me, for this patient, if the patient was resectable, we have a study, thankfully, but off of study, I probably would have just given surgery and see how they did afterwards, just based upon the data and based upon what we know. Obviously, there's a role in downstaging, but to me, the downstaging question for this patient, if you knew they were N2 positive, would it have changed anything? Well, the patient was still resectable, it was not bulky nodes, and we probably would have ended up in the same place. You know, but if there's a patient that's borderline resectable or big, or you have any concerns, then I probably would have given something. And for me, I would have given OSI. I know that's off-label and there's no data, but for me, if you're looking for a response, that's what I would give.
Yeah, I would agree. And you read the mind of the crowd, Jyoti. That's a question here. How often are you getting testing? I think in the era of neoadjuvant immunotherapy, you have to get molecular testing on patients. You don't want to give patients the wrong treatment. So I do get testing. I do wait for it. It's more painful to wait for it in the early stage setting than it is in the metastatic setting. Patients are eager to get to the OR. They can go to multiple different hospitals a couple blocks away to get surgery. So it is an important discussion. I think that neoadjuvant TKI, tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and other therapies is building, you know, sort of momentum. As you mentioned, the NeoAdora trial ongoing. I think it's an important question to answer. As the moderator, though, we're running out of time here, so let's get moving.
Thank you, Dr. Sabari. So now we'll talk about updated two slides here, disease-free survival and overall survival. So this is the ADORA study. We're looking at updated disease-free survival. And as you can see here, without looking through the numbers, you can pretty much drive a truck through these curves. And for me, as I learned in medical school, if you can drive a truck at this level, it's significant. You can see the data here. It's relatively mature and is looking now at overall survival, you can't drive quite a big truck through these, but again, pretty impressive data. So adjuvant osimertinib clearly improves overall survival by real numbers in this patient population. So for me, this ends up being a no-brainer, and we finally have mature data for both OS and PFS. The big debate after the PFS came out, was it gonna hold through for overall survival? We all bet on it. The bet would have come out. Now we're going to talk about the LAURA study. Now this is literally right off the headlines. What did we decide, Monday?
Yeah, this is like 4 days old.
4 days old data, so the press release, and we don't have the data that has not been published yet. So these are patients with stage 3 unresectable non-small cell lung cancer. So completely different population, unresectable, treated with chemoradiotherapy. You can see the inclusion part of the clinical study here. 18 years or older, curative intent therapy, sequential versus concurrent chemoradiation, most of us, at least in the United States, get concurrent chemoradiation, and randomized 2-to-1 to get osimertinib versus placebo. The interesting thing here, and we'll talk about this in a second, is they were treated until objective radiologic disease progression. And all we know right now is that this is a positive study.
Out of curiosity, in this trial, what were you doing before the data press release? I mean, were you giving adjuvant or consolidation durvalumab in a known EGFR mutant patient, or were you using osimertinib off-label?
So for me, you know, based upon the adjuvant OC data that looked very good in the post-operative setting, to me it was a no-brainer to use this off-label. I tell the patients, hey, it's an off-label use. I'm not, you know, can I tell you it's going to work for certain? Absolutely not. But based upon what we know, I recommended to a couple of patients. I also, even before the Adura data came out, you know, we all had those patients of stage 3.9 disease that are 30 years old that you do surgery for, and I'm probably not the only person at this table that gave adjuvant osimertinib off-label in the post-operative setting or even after radiation. So to me, this is, you know, we haven't seen the numbers, it's positive. I guess my question to you is, and then we can ask each other questions, is what do you guys think about the indefinite treatment? That to me is a little bit of a strange thing in a curable disease.
Right, we know that we'll be over-treating 30% of patients, right, or cured with chemo radiation alone, and so it's certainly difficult, but I'm excited to see the data and see the magnitude of benefit and see the amount of discontinuation there was in the osimertinib arm. Probably, you know, 3 to 5 years I'd want to stop for most patients. But certainly, you know, I think this is, I had already stopped giving Durva to patients with EGFR mutation several years ago. And probably before I see the data, I'm going to have this discussion with many of our patients and start using it in clinic.
And I think that's super important. You know, Josh, you mentioned a minute ago, we talked a little bit about, you know, getting the biomarkers in the preoperative scenario. You just saw a patient's second opinion. Patient had chemo followed by adjuvant immunotherapy for a year, relapsed, and had an ALK fusion. We know that ALK is very similar to osimertinib with no benefit from immunotherapy. You can make the argument could have given ALK in the adjuvant setting. We now know that there's data for that, but I think it reminds us that almost anybody right now of lung cancer, if you have a lung cancer diagnosis, you need to get NGS done on tissue, liquid biopsy at least. So, Josh, what are your thoughts? How long would you do this for?
So I understand the criticism, the concern with the stage 1A, maybe even 1B patient population, the Adura data. As you move to 3A disease, I think it's a no-brainer. Now, this population, the unresectable population, 3B and 3C, you know, this is where I think the therapies are going to have the most benefit for patients. In my mind, these are patients already with micrometastatic disease. They were, by definition, unresectable. So, Jyoti, I'm looking forward to seeing this data as well. The question of the duration of therapy, I think, is complex, whether it be 3 years, 5 years, indefinite. I think we're going to need to use some form of, you know, ctDNA, MRD-type testing to help us better understand the duration of treatment. But, you know, I've already been doing this in clinic. I'm glad the study was done, and I look forward to seeing the data. So we have some questions from the audience here. So what is the optimal time to order and conduct EGFR testing? And I want to point that out, that they asked EGFR testing. Are you doing piecemeal testing in the early stage setting, Jyoti, or are you doing broad panel NGS?
So we're very lucky institutionally that we do reflexive NGS on all of our patients, both DNA and RNA. It's within the institution. It's taken some time to get that workflow done, but my sense is that most of these patients are diagnosed by EBUS, and so tissue is very precious, and thinking about sort of parsing this out over time, you know, really, I think, makes sequential testing less attractive.
And then, Alex, are you doing both liquid and tissue up front in a stage 1B, 2, or 3A patient, or only tissue? How are you getting this reimbursed in your practice?
So reimbursement, thankfully, has been an issue. I'm sure it is for some, but for us, it hasn't been. I'm a firm believer in getting as much information. I was in an ad board earlier in the day, and when people asked a very similar question, I'm like, you know, the amount of money we spend on lung cancer now, even in its earlier stages, for a year of adjuvant immunotherapy is over six figures, right? We're talking 100,000 to 250,000. So to me, getting all the information you possibly can, a lot of these patients are getting an EBUS, and you're like, did you get a good sample? Did you not get a good sample? So for me, just getting all that data is super helpful. So I get it on everybody. It's also helpful. I think the reality is, you know, we get a lot of our blood-based assays back a lot before the tissue. It just sometimes just takes too long between the cells being, the blocks being cut, the tests being done, all that goes on. It's a faraway lab. So for me, I'm getting it all up front, and I figure more information is better. I have some reservations because it's really financial toxicity, but at the end of the day, I think I'm able to make better decisions.
Yeah. Just a thought-provoking question, and Dr. Patel, you're going to answer this later. If osimertinib is used in the adjuvant setting, the curative intent setting, and patients recur, how does that change your, you know, frontline therapy in the metastatic setting? And with that, I'll turn it to you, Dr. Patel, to discuss the evolving role of EGFR-targeted therapies in advanced non-small cell lung cancer. And this is bread and butter, common EGFR mutations.
It was much more straightforward a year ago, even if it is bread and butter. How about that? So we'll start with a case, a 52-year-old woman with some shortness of breath. She's found to have a pleural effusion, undergoes a thoracentesis, and has an adenocarcinoma. Further workup shows that she has bilateral lung involvement, so stage 4A disease. She undergoes testing from the pleural fluid and is found to have exon 21, L858R, and zero PD-L1 expression. After the fluid's removed, she has good performance status. So what do you recommend for this patient today? Let's talk about it. So the patient, this was historic, so she was started on osimertinib. And had a good response for 12 months, but unfortunately developed progressive disease with bone, liver, and pulmonary involvement. She still has good performance status. So at this juncture, she has progressive disease, good performance status. What therapy would you recommend? So let's move to, first we'll break this down by talking about frontline options. So certainly FLAURA established osimertinib as the standard of care for first-line therapy. So remember, osimertinib was compared to gefitinib or erlotinib, and this led to an improvement in progression-free survival as well as overall survival in osimertinib. Really became the standard of care in the United States. There are countries in which it's not available as a frontline therapy, but for us practicing here, it is a standard of care. Since then, we've heard about FLAURA2, and so we know that PFS of osimertinib alone is, although exciting, is still not adequate for the majority of our patients. And so the idea was felt to bring chemotherapy up into the frontline setting and to intensify therapy to improve outcomes. So we've seen the sort of first endpoint of FLAURA2, improvements in progression-free survival. So osimertinib with platinum and pemetrexed leads to significant improvements in progression-free survival. So across the board, about 9 months, you can see investigator assessment as well as BICR. And so this benefit is certainly exciting. We still don't have OS results. So based on this PFS result and earlier this week, the FDA approved osimertinib with chemotherapy for patients with classical mutations. And so this is a relevant and first-line option for some of your patients. The other data set that we've seen is MARIPOSA. So this is AMI plus laser. So laser is pretty analogous to osimertinib as a third-generation EGFR TKI versus osimertinib. So remember, amivantamab is infusional. You're getting the plus the oral drug versus osimertinib alone. This also met its PFS endpoint, so the hazard ratio is 0.5 5.8, and you can see that, again, we see an improvement of about 9 months of disease control, so 25 versus 17 months. And certainly, it's immature, but trends towards improved OS. There were more discontinuations of therapy in both of the investigational arms, in both FLAURA2 as well as MARIPOSA. So now that we have two data sets to add to FLAURA, as well as one that's been FDA approved, when you see a patient with an EGFR mutation newly diagnosed, what are the conversations that you're having in clinic, and what are you recommending?
I'll go first. So this is a challenging conversation. And you know, when this data first was presented, both FLAURA and MARIPOSA, everybody was very excited because we are making headway. And you know, despite the fact, you know, I'm sure you guys are similar to me, when somebody has an EGFR mutation, say, I have great news to the patient, your tumor is going to respond, we have something that's going to work very well. Then the reality sets in where, you know, these patients tend to be young. Median progression-free survival is 8 to 24 months, depending on the mutation, disease burden. So it's only 1 to 2 years, right, at most. So it's still a bad disease and a problem. I think we're all very excited about this data, but it also comes with two risks. You know, the chemotherapy is still chemo. Carbo-PEM is a very well-tolerated regimen, but it's still infusional chemotherapy given every 3 weeks. No alopecia, a little bit of neuropathy, mild renal dysfunction. Patients are undergoing chemotherapy. Amulizertinib, oral with an IV combination as well, has some of the cutaneous issues, right? Have the infusion-related reactions. If you've given Ami a couple of times, you're used to it, but some physicians get anxious about it. Certainly it's anxiety-producing to patients. So I have the discussion right now, and I think it's going to be a much more challenging discussion now going forward, which is right for the patient. I mean, it's easy if they're older and they're a little bit more fragile, but these are young, healthy patients. They'll say to you, I want to live as long as I possibly can. I think I'm anxiously awaiting, how do you figure out which patient is more likely? There's been a lot of talk, and we've all heard these discussions about patients who don't clear their circulating tumor DNA. That would be a great thing if we were able to identify those patients and add on those regimens. Or, I mean, this is some obvious things, big bulk of disease. You know those patients are going to do worse. Maybe it'll be RB1, maybe it'll be P53, maybe it'll be none of these things. But I think it'll be helpful if we can stratify who's going to benefit. Since we don't have any of that right now, I have a discussion, and I try and figure out what the patient wants in terms of their level of aggressiveness. And I also know for a fact that if I say one thing, Dr. Sabari, in second opinion, will say the opposite, because this is going to be all up for grabs. We're going to have three really good choices.
I would never disagree with you, first off. And second off, you know, if you think about the FLAURA data, you know, osimertinib is a tremendous therapy. It's changed the landscape for our patients with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. That being said, you know, there are still subsets of patients who can do better. So when you look at the FLAURA data, you know, if you look at exon 19 del, median PFS about 22 months. When you look at L858R, it's about 14.4 months. So we know that population does not perform as well. CNS metastasis is a common question. Co-alterations, P53, P10, for example. What do you do with an RB1 up front, right? We're starting to, you know, try to better understand this population. And then what about those patients who start on osimertinib and have positive ctDNA 4 to 6 weeks post-initiation? Maybe that's a higher risk population. So we are studying those subgroups of patients now to see if the addition of chemotherapy in a randomized fashion may improve PFS as well as overall survival. Once approved, I will utilize amivantamab and lazertinib in the frontline setting because I think it builds upon the current paradigm. And, you know, I don't think ami and laz is the end-all be-all. I think we need to build upon that as well into the future. The HER3 ADC will hear about, you know, there are other options coming. All of this comes, though, at a cost, right? Toxicity. So that 84-year-old grandma that you sent me for a second opinion, osimertinib alone. You know, I agree with you. But in a young, fit patient, 40, who, you know, 2 years PFS or 3 years survival is not enough, I think we need to do more for our patients. Jyoti, what would you do in clinic? 30-year-old patient.
30-year-old patient. So deletion 19, I think that's pretty easy. Osimertinib. With L858R, I think it's much less predictable. I've had some patients do really well for a long time and other patients who progress quickly, as manifested by what we know PFS is. At this juncture off of trial, I tend to use osimertinib alone simply because I am still struggling and grappling with sequential therapies. So the conversation I have with many of these patients is, yes, we have a great first option, but what comes in the second and third line option landscape is rapidly changing, and it may be that in a couple of years we have different therapies. But I have not been intensifying therapy as much. That being said, there are other ways to intensify therapy that are still investigational, like local consolidation after best response. Some people are still using anti-VEGF therapies. We have conflicting data with ramucirumab, so certainly I think it will be interesting to see OS results, as well as in some crazy world where we do head-to-head studies.
It's really an exciting time. We may have multiple different regimens approved in the front line. Dr. Patel, what about second line?
Right, so we know that most patients in the United States get osimertinib, and we've learned a lot about how what happens at the time of progression. So certainly I think early on many of us felt that most resistance was on target with EGFR mutations, and a lot of those were gatekeeper mutations analogous to T790, such as 797S. What we're finding is that that probably represents a smaller number of patients, but perhaps about 20% of patients will end up with on-target EGFR mutations. I think we're seeing a lot of patients now who are developing off-target mutations or other targetable mutations, so most commonly MET amplification, but certainly we see other sort of hotspots with ALK fusions, RET translocations, HER2 amplifications, and BRAF. Many of those we can target with two oral therapies, sometimes IV targeted therapy, as well as continuation of osimertinib. And unfortunately, for the largest number of patients, we still don't understand the mechanism of resistance. There's a subset of patients that will have histologic transformation. We alluded to that early on. Most of those patients will end up having RB and P53 at the time of diagnosis, and so we have a heightened sensitivity when we see those patients progress and always do tissue biopsy for those patients. So at the time of progression, I think we have a couple of certainly interesting data sets to look at, and this is MARIPOSA 2. So MARIPOSA and MARIPOSA 2 came out at the same time, and this is amivantamab plus chemotherapy with or without laser. The idea was that laser needed to be added because it was unclear whether AMI had significant CNS activity, and this was versus chemotherapy, so carboplatin and pemetrexed. So you can see the gray line is chemotherapy alone. The two lines, the blue line is AMI plus chemotherapy, and the purple line is AMI plus laser plus chemotherapy. Of note, laser was started sort of after the chemotherapy, because when we gave all four drugs, there was excessive myelosuppression. And so what we can see is that we're seeing improvements, certainly in progression-free survival. We saw improvements in response rate, and we await to see what OS looks like. But this was met with a lot of enthusiasm. Progression-free survival hazard ratio is 0.41 and 0.38 versus chemotherapy. So certainly combination therapy is much better than chemotherapy alone. There are increased toxicities. There are particular toxicities, such as the risk of VTE, that we now commonly prophylax against. But certainly, this is certainly interesting data and has met and is now on NCCN guidelines, but does not have an FDA approval. The other data set deals with an antibody drug conjugate, HER3-DXd, or petrutumab deruxtecan. And this was presented by Helena Yu in Singapore at the World Conference on Lung Cancer. And so this is an antibody-drug conjugate that targets HER3, which is upregulated with EGFR inhibition. This is a phase 2 trial in which patients were often heavily pretreated and had already received platinum therapy. The response rates across the board were a little bit lower than in the very early phase 1 experience, so about 30%. But importantly, patients also demonstrated CNS response, and patients, regardless of mechanism of resistance, developed or had response. The median OS in this heavily pretreated population was certainly of interest, and so we await to see some of this, these studies as they pan out. So now, for a patient post-osimertinib, how are you approaching it beyond doing a biopsy to look for a targetable mutation?
So a couple of things. So one is, you know, the biopsy is going to be helpful, but with the addition of amivantamab, that eliminates the need, because amivantamab covers probably covers C797S, covers other mutations, as well as covers c-MET. For me, I'm looking at the Mariposa 2, and I would be giving people, if they don't have a trial, chemo with amivantamab. I think the jury will be out as to whether or not you add lazertinib. It does come with those increased side effects, mainly VTE. But for me, the Mariposa 2 is really kind of clinches it. It also, you brought this up before, Jody, is what do you do in the frontline setting? Because now you can rescue some of these patients, for lack of a better term, with both chemo and amivantamab and give that to them later. You're obviously delaying, you know, patients will get the same side effects, but they're getting it later, probably a little bit less of a time. So for me, that's right now, that's a good way to sequence it. You start off pretty well. Maybe you'll get lucky. Maybe that patient will have 3 years, 4 years of therapy, do really well. And then you can add on some of these therapies down the road, maybe minimizing some of those side effects. On the contrary, just getting back to frontline, I always have to be reminded that even in the EGFR world, only about 50 to 75% of patients make it to second line therapy. We think we're better physicians than we are. But some patients will have new brain mets, some patients will progress, they'll be older, and they don't even get a chance to get some of these drugs. So maybe it's, I know it was a segue, but maybe it's worthwhile giving some of those drugs first. But for me right now, if they're getting OC frontline, I'm looking at that Mariposa 2 data, and it looks pretty darn good.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, we do need to resequence these patients. You have to rule out histologic transformation. We know that, you know, post-osimertinib, we're seeing increased rates of small cell transformation, squam transformation, and just putting someone on a regimen without rebiopsying is foolish. You know, sometimes we do identify MET-AMP and other mutations where patients are eligible for trial or off-label combinations. But I think when you don't have a trial, Alex, or if there is no, you know, available genomic information to match therapy, I do think AMI plus chemotherapy makes sense. And again, you have to explain to the patient the toxicity profile. Jyoti, a very interesting question from the audience here. A specific case, patient gets first line, you know, erlotinib, second line osimertinib, and they have an L858R, L792F, which I just looked up. It's a point mutation in exon 20, and it's a gatekeeper mutation, as well as a T790M. So the three mutations here that are resistant, you know, what do you think about the potential role for fourth generation EGFR inhibitors in the future? Or should we be thinking more broad approaches like AMI-LAS or AMI-chemo or, you know, combos with chemotherapeutic options?
Certainly, we're seeing really early data with fourth generation EGFR TKIs in these patients. I think we still need to understand durability with some of these agents despite initial response. And so that may shape my conversation. But certainly, if a trial is available for this patient, that would be, I think, very, very reasonable to do. Off of a trial, I'd probably go back to Mariposa 2 or a new sort of fallback.
Yeah, I know, Alex, you probably have every one of these fourth generation inhibitor studies open in your clinic. I've personally been disappointed with the fourth gen inhibitors. I haven't seen broad activity. I also haven't seen broad durability. You know, osimertinib is a very good therapy. And unlike first and second generation EGFR TKI, where 60, 70% of patients have the same resistance mutation, T790M, post-OSI, you're seeing that sort of wild range of different alterations. So very hard to study. A lot of these fourth generation inhibitors are failing in the later line setting and are potentially moving to combination strategies in the earlier line setting.
No, I agree completely. You know, there's a lot of good fourth generation drugs, a lot of C797S drugs, plus or minus T790M. The data is good, but it kind of pales to where we want to be. Right? We would love to see these 70 to 80% response rates or even 50% response rates. I think most of what we're seeing is stable disease. And I think, you know, while it's great to put those patients on study because we need to answer those questions, off of study, I mean, AMI does hit a lot of these things. You know, mechanistically, you have an internal resistance mutation, but you're able to target EGFR at the cell surface, right? It's a monoclonal. So you're able to overcome a lot of these mutations kind of in a mutation agnostic way. So to me, that kind of hits everything, and they're probably going to need chemo as well. You know, since you brought up the concept of fourth generation TKIs, I think they're going to be a huge role, but I think they're probably going to be earlier on or maybe even with amivantamab. You know, looking at those combinations and delaying that resistance as well.
Yeah. Jyoti, last question before we move on to exon 20. You know, back to that point, if a patient receives adjuvant osimertinib, let's say it's a patient with L858R, has progression on therapy, let's say a year on osimertinib has progression, multiple sites of disease, how do you think of that patient in the recurrent metastatic setting? So this is the second time the person's asking, so they really do want to know the answer. So what would you do in this setting?
So for a patient who progresses on on osimertinib adjuvantly, I would consider it sort of a second line candidate and say probably that patient had micrometastatic disease I wasn't aware of. I'd probably, again, go back to MARIPOSA 2. I think it's a little bit more difficult when patients recur after they've come off of osimertinib, so they've completed 3 years. So then my experience has been able, you know, I've been able to re-challenge with good success, but is there a, you know, is this a group of patients that you'd want to intensify with either AMI laser slash OSI or chemo and OSI?
Yeah, so despite us talking about all these therapies, unfortunately, a lot of our patients do run out of lines of treatment, and we know oftentimes still offering conventional chemotherapies in the third, fourth line setting. So clearly, we need better therapies in this setting. And with that, I want to turn it over to the handsome Dr. Alex Spira to talk about the evolving role of EGFR-targeted therapy in exon 20. We're friends. I can do that.
You can say anything you want, Dr. Sabari. So we'll now talk about exon 20 insertion mutations. So we'll talk about a case. So 62-year-old male, former light smoker, found to have a right-sided lung mass, no mediastinal involvement, underwent right upper lobectomy, stage 2A disease, and we gave him cisplatin pemetrexed because we love cisplatin, much better than carboplatin. This patient did well at 6 months, but at 1 year developed bilateral metastatic disease, consistent with recurrence, low PD-L score. So recurred about a year after adjuvant chemotherapy. Patient had a mutation, we'll talk about it in a second, confirmed on both tissue and blood, and here are the results. Patient in their blood was found to have an exon 20 insertion. We won't talk about which of the 100 mutations Dr. Sabari talked about before, but this had a relatively common mutation.
Alex, just to put this into context, you're in clinic and you see a patient with stage 2, what are you quoting them at recurrence rate? You know, I mean, you know, here we're looking at a case, but does this happen in your practice? What are your numbers?
Yeah, I quote them about 50%.
Yeah, same in my practice. So this is something we see on a day-to-day basis.
Yep. So patient recurred about a year after, has an exon 20. What would you recommend for this patient? I will ask my esteemed colleagues, what would you do?
It's been a year since the adjuvant therapy, so I'd probably give chemotherapy with AMI.
Yeah, I would agree with that. AMI, carbo, PEM here makes sense, especially with the Papillon data, which you'll talk about. You know, how long would you wait until, you know, recurrence to retreat with carboplatin? That's a common question we get.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those things, depends on the age. I mean, this patient could clearly tolerate it. Now we're going to give carbo instead of cis, but you better tolerate it. I think this will come down to what the patient wants to do. If you can start talking to them, they ask you the question, do I need chemo again, doc? Then I might lean more towards AMI, but if they want to go gusto, and I don't think you can go wrong with either one of these solutions. This is right at the cusp. If it was 3 to 6 months, I would say AMI alone. If it was 2 years, maybe more triplet therapy. But I think at this point, I personally would see what the patient wanted to do. We'll talk about amivantamab. It's a bispecific antibody. It was developed originally mainly for EGFR to overcome secondary resistance with the MET, so it's got two hats on it, as I like to say. But it works across multiple EGFR mutations, as you've heard today through our different topics of conversation, but also can overcome and probably prevent MET resistance as well. It binds the extracellular portion of EGFR, and we can show you different slides. It has multiple different ways that it's believed to work. We'll talk now about Papillon. Papillon is a frontline study, so these are patients newly diagnosed. So the standard of care before coming into the frontline therapy was chemotherapy alone. Amivantamab was approved in second line. We'll look at those slides in a second. But this is comparing amivantamab chemo to chemo alone in the frontline scenario. And as you can see here, you can drive a moderate-sized truck through those curves with a hazard ratio of 0.395, almost 0.4. PFS 11.4 versus 6.7 months. Clear improvement of progression-free survival versus chemo alone in the frontline setting. And you can see the waterfall plots on the right, pretty impressive there. So you're getting the benefits of both chemo and a targeted therapy. And side effects, clearly more than you would expect with either, but both very well tolerated, and probably not a lot of cross-toxicity given the two. This is the study, probably went a little bit out of order. Dr. Sabari reminded me before in our prep. But this is where AMI was first approved in the second-line setting. So amivantamab was first approved in the second-line setting after chemotherapy. 40% response rate in the second-line setting, duration of response 11 months, PFS of 8.3 months. And again, a good waterfall plot here. We talked a little before about all the different mutations. You see there's a lot of different mutations. We really haven't been able to drill down. Is it better in one versus another one? Probably is, but even in these large studies, the N is still too small to really know and really take a deep look at. Common side effects here, infusion-related reactions. The day one is split into two doses, depending on body surface area, because everybody pretty much always reacts. It's only two-thirds here in my clinic. It's about 90% if you ask them enough that everybody always reacts on the first day, but never on the second day. EGFR toxicity, rash, paronychia. The MET-related side effects are unique with this drug. Hypoalbuminemia and edema. Tolerated well in most patients, a little bit more challenging in the older patient population, and not a lot of dose discontinuation. So we now looked at both frontline and second-line data for these patients. There's a lot of drugs being tested in the second line setting. Firmo, Sunvo, CLN-081, Zipalertinib, I think is the right name.
Zipalertinib, that is correct.
Thank you. Blue-451 was discontinued just recently. Blueprint decided to go in a different direction. In the frontline setting, we had some other studies, but we have Firmo ongoing. It's a couple of frontline studies. We talked before about amivantamab, but MOBO was approved in the second line and actually withdrew because the frontline study did not meet the standards. So we lost one of those drugs recently in the second line setting because of the first line results. So there's a lot to talk about here and a lot of drugs emerging in a rapidly evolving field. Talk a little bit about the Wukong 1 and Wukong 15 data. This is frontline Sunvo. I'll say Sunvo because it's easier to say and it's late in the evening. As you can see here, pretty impressive response rates at both the 200 and 300 milligram daily levels, confirmed about 78%, which is pretty impressive. It's a little bit higher than we've been seeing with some of the other drugs, with a reasonable duration response and a PFS approaching 10 to 12 months. Sunvo is an orally administered TKI, with some promising activity here. This is reported at ESMO. So a lot to talk about right now. Where do you think the field is moving? And you know, my guess is we're gonna have a frontline TKI probably approved within 12 to 24 months. What are you doing right now for your frontline patients? And what are you gonna do when you have a TKI approved? Aside from data that's going to be cross-trial comparison, which we're never supposed to do, but what do you think you're going to end up doing? What do you do now for frontline, and what do you think you're going to be doing in a year, Jody?
So certainly I think for frontline, I have rapidly embraced Papillon, so carbo-pem, ami for those patients. I think that's a high bar. It is a very positive trial with deep response rate and good duration of response, and so certainly the newer generation TKIs have their work cut out for them. It's a regimen that comes with toxicity, but again, if how patients prioritize toxicity and outcomes is going to be an interesting and evolving field.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'll be looking at response rates that may or may not be different. Again, cross-trial comparisons, a lot done ex-US as well. You'll get down to chemo-AMI, which is all intravenously chemo, versus an oral TKI, right? And there's certain advantages to doing that as well. Josh, what are you doing now, and what are you going to do?
Yeah, so based on the NCCN recommendations, I am using the Papillon regimen, so AMI plus chemotherapy in the frontline setting. But I agree with you. I think this will likely be replaced in the future. So question to you, Alex, why the AMI plus chemo? Why not AMI alone? And then also, why are some of these newer agents just single agent TKI versus chemotherapy? And what happened to MOBO?
There's a lot there. So, it's interesting. I think the decision was made based upon the response rates in the second and third line setting for AMI that, chemo still works. I mean, we all throw chemo under the bridge, but chemo is a pretty well-tolerated regimen. These are young patients. They'll tolerate carbopemotrexid pretty darn well. No alopecia, minimal neuropathy. So it was a high bar, and I think it was felt by some that if you went up against chemotherapy with amivantamab, you might lose, so they decided to put it together. So I think that's why, but it's a great question. What if you gave AMI by itself in the frontline setting? Would that be superior or at least equivalent to chemotherapy? We'll never know. But that's why it's currently in the frontline setting. I forgot your second question. What happened to MOBO? MOBO was a tough drug. MOBO, for those of you, many of you probably given poziotinib, a lot of these TKIs that have a lot of wild-type EGFR toxicity are just tough to give. Those of us are old enough to remember the days of Arisa was given a lot. Afatinib is one of these drugs as well. A lot of cutaneous toxicity in this. You know, the FDA labeled dose of mobocertinib was 160 milligrams. And I found, at least in my clinical study, on clinical study, which are, you know, patients that can travel, tough to keep them at that dose. So they had to be reduced to 120, then you had to reduce them to 80, and they were just not able to tolerate it. A lot of dose interruptions. So for me, it was a level, it was a first generation drug. It was a great drug. It kind of opened the door to all these drugs, but I think the toxicity limited the dose intensity that we can give. I think these newer drugs are just better drugs. So these newer drugs are clearly better drugs, and we'll wait to see. I forgot what your second question was.
Yeah, I forgot what it was too. I always do worry though about CNS penetration of these agents. You know, do you think some of the novel, you know, sort of next generation exon 20 inhibitors are gonna have better CNS penetration? Or do you think you achieve decent CNS penetration with AMI chemo? Remember, those patients were excluded from the Papillon trial, meaning active untreated CNS metastasis.
You know, great question. So a lot of the new generation drugs are designed to have CNS penetration, and even if they don't, they have it anecdotally. So we're getting to the point that these, you know, CNS, these patients, it's not just all talk. The incidence of CNS metastases at progression, at presentation and at progression is very high. It's probably even higher than the typical EGFR mutation. So this is important, right? You know, patients have to undergo stereotactic radiosurgery, whole brain radiation, you know, a lot of sequela there. So it's very important. So I think there is clear activity of these drugs in the CNS, but you forget that pemetrexed does have some CNS activity. It's, you kind of always say no, but you know, we've all given these patients and we've seen tumor shrink as well. And you know, although the AMI studies excluded brain metastases, there's a lot of anecdotal data. Plus, if you start looking at Mariposa and Mariposa 2, there's some hints of buried in the data of CNS activity as well. So I think these drugs do get in, so it's a matter of how much. But it's rapidly evolving, and I think we're gonna be left with a lot of good choices where a year from now, we'll probably be back here and say, what do you do? You know, we have different choices.
I hope we're back here with many new therapies for our patients. So I agree, CNS as well as acquired resistance is going to be the next frontier in the setting. Dr. Patel, a question for you. This is a comment from the audience, but I also actually had a second opinion 2 weeks ago with the same question. Why do we feel comfortable or confident excluding immunotherapy from the EGFR exon 20 population? You know that half of those patients are former or active smokers. Do you feel confident removing pembro from that, you know, regimen in patients?
I do, simply because, again, sort of retrospective reviews, immunotherapy, monotherapy has minimal efficacy for these patients. I don't think we get that much more with chemotherapy. Certainly, you know, I think we learn from studies like Libretto, right, which RET patients were able to get chemotherapy or chemoimmuno, and the outcomes didn't look that different, so it's probably not deleterious up front, but I do worry about sequencing for these patients. So what happens when I give a TKI afterwards? Would there be an increased risk of tox?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, we know for some TKI, you see toxicity sequential to the PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitor. We don't necessarily see that with amivantamab, but we don't have huge, large prospective data sets. So that is something to look, you know, sort of and think about in our clinical practices. So I'm going to take the opportunity to thank both of you for a wonderful discussion. Also to thank PeerView for a great event this evening. I'm quite impressed. The meeting has not even started and we packed the room. Alex, it's all you.
It's all me, Dr. Sabari. Thank you.
So, well, thank you, everyone, and have a great evening and enjoy the conference.
This activity is certified by PVI, PeerView Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/SKH860. This activity is supported by independent educational grants from AstraZeneca and Janssen Biotech Incorporated, administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC.